Hello, and welcome to Drawing Blood. I'm Christy Slobogan.
And I'm Emma Merkling.
And today, we are going to be talking about human remains in museums, their display, and some of the ethical and political issues that come up around that type of display. We'll also be talking about how this display of human remains relates to the history of science, of course, as well as the history of art and the history of imperialism. So obviously with all of those topics, we have some content warnings for the episode. We'll be talking about, obviously, dead bodies and death. We'll be talking about the handling of corpses. We'll also be talking about colonial and racist violence. And we'll be linking to and talking about some potentially distressing images of dead bodies. But we'll try to make sure that we're flagging those as they come up as well.
So actually, I want us to start in a slightly different way
okay.
today. I'm going to read you a letter and then show you a picture.
Okay.
So this letter comes from a show that we're going to get to later in the episode by a contemporary artist called Gala Paris Kim. She's an LA-based artist. And this letter and the objects I'm going to show you were part of an installation in her first ever UK solo show at Gasworks earlier this year called Out of an Instance of Expiration Comes a Perennial Showing, which was just, like, astoundingly good. And I'm really sad that it closed before we got a chance to go together.
Because you did. I think you texted me immediately when you were there. You're like, we have to do an episode on this. So I only ever got a couple of WhatsApp photos, so I'm really excited to actually talk about it.
We're going to talk about quite a lot of them, probably at the end of the episode. But let me start by reading you this letter. So it's from earlier this year, and it's to Daniel Antoine, acting keeper at the British Museum, Department of Egypt and Sudan, with a CC of John H. Taylor, who I believe is the curator.
And it's from Paris Kim.
From Paris Kim.
Got it. Okay.
And the subject line is Sites Beyond the Grave. Dear Mr. Antoine, thank you for your research and for making information available to the public regarding the plans for the afterlife of the ancient Egyptians in your collection. It is evident in the work your department undertakes that the British Museum is committed to the care and research of the people in your collection. The conservation efforts towards the material remains of ancient Egyptians in your department are remarkable and important and seem to be aligned with their plans for their afterlife, as evidenced by their careful planning, meticulous detail, and resource allocation to the preservation of the body and spirit. Since they have expressed and determined the way their material and spiritual parts were to be kept, this provokes several questions about their current existence in the museum, out of their final resting place, and a closer look at their condition in their current and ongoing afterlife. So she talks a little bit then about the capabilities for reincarnation, the way they exist in many shapes, both as mummies and as statues. She says, some may have already reconstituted into the forms now in your galleries and storage, so keeping them has turned the museum into their current accommodation. Since we cannot yet be certain of the mechanics of the afterlife, we could consider the perpetual plans of the persons under your charge as a guide for their care and, as such, in their display. It could seem daunting to understand and accommodate so many people's eternal plans. Fortunately, many of the labels you've provided in your current display already outline the specific needs you can follow for their exposition. These guidelines might not interfere with the museography and the day-to-day activities of the museum and could be an opportunity to curate for that ancient audience and consider their positioning and views for sites beyond the grave. It is a small step to repair the potential disruption caused by the relocation of people who planned so well for their afterlife and expand on knowledge of aspects of life which might be lost to us now.
So, I have a lot of questions. I'm trying to write them down without moving the microphone. So, first of all, this letter, was this part of the display? This was part of the exhibition?
It's positioned next to an object.
Okay,
which I'm going to show you.
But she did actually send it?
Yes, she did actually send
it. Okay, so it's not just a performance, it's also like an intervention. Okay, so the themes that are coming out from this for me are this idea of museums as caring space, which of course then we think of curation, you know, curative, those kinds of words all mashed up together, and the idea that museums are taking care of these objects. So what happens when that object is a person?
Yeah.
And then you get to things, you know, ideas around, it gets almost medical in that way, like having to care for a body that is decomposing.
She says conservation.
Yeah, right? Conservation.
It's, yeah, this idea of care in multiple ways, right? Exactly. Like, the caring for these physical remains and also for their spiritual well-being.
Physical, spiritual, and even more than, like, physical as embodied, but, like, physical as in a museum object. As yeah. in, like, caring for it as if it's a painting or a sculpture, as she says. Exactly. You know?
And I think it's fascinating because it's an approach that's so different. It's tackling this question that we'll get to, you know, about museums and human remains and display in a really interesting way that I hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested to see what objects she paired it with. But I also think the other big thing that she flags up, and it ties in with care, is consent.
Yeah.
And that question of, like, okay, they planned so much for this. Are you doing what's right for them? Yeah. Or did they consent to this? And they're outside of their original resting place or their planned resting place. So I think the questions of care and consent and display are all in this.
And the role of the museum, not only as curation, conservation, as you said, but as tomb, right? That, like, it's now become their tomb.
Which nobody thinks, you don't really think about that.
And in fact, I've seen an interview with her, I think it was an interview, where she talks about how we should see it first as tomb and secondly as having these sort of other
functions. It's so interesting to think about a museum as a tomb because I feel like museum workers don't want to think of it that way because that evokes, like, a place where things go to die or after they died, and you want to be breathing life into these objects. You know what I mean? Or at least that's the way that museums frame themselves. They're like, bring history to life with...
But think about a graveyard. It is still a place. People visit them. They bring offerings.
Found a new one last week.
No, but I'm just saying, like, it's not just... Even if you think of it as a tomb is not a static place, you know? It's specifically to be thinking... So this exhibition actually doesn't... The letters and the objects are not just to the British Museum. It's also to other collections that have human remains. But the one that I... What I think is particularly interesting about Egyptians, you brought up consent, is that this is a case where we know pretty clearly what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
That it's written. It's a rare case of, like, having an... We have proof of what the ancients wanted.
Yeah.
And also knowing that specifically by having disturbed these bodies, the thing that was the most important to them, which is care in the afterlife. I mean, just picture the pyramids.
Yeah, of course.
Is disrupted.
Yeah.
And so it's a particularly sharp point at which a lot of these questions come into focus.
Yeah.
So I'm not actually yet going to show you the object it was paired with. I'm going to show you a different one from the exhibition, but which also references the British Museum.
Okay.
So here's the object in question. Do you want to just describe what we're looking at?
Okay, so it is a tomb. But I assume since it's by a contemporary artist, she has constructed it herself. And it's a rusticated gray and white color. It's quite simple, but with some patterned insets along the sides. And around the bottom, there's arrows to point you to walk around it.
Yeah, there's like a semicircle with arrows on it.
Yeah.
And I also want you to notice its positioning in the sort of square room of the exhibition.
Yeah, it's angled.
Yeah, which is quite striking when you're in the actual space. It's, like, really in your way.
So is it trying to face a specific direction?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's referring to a specific tomb. It's a sarcophagus, and it's, I think, a plaster cast of it.
Okay.
And it's referring to one in the British Museum's collection, which is currently positioned, I believe, facing southwest. But the Egyptians believe that the body needs to face east to face the rising sun. And so the markers, this is positioned facing east, and the markers on the floor indicate the motion that it would have to take to be repositioned within the museum from southwest to east.
I see.
With a simple move, she's done one small act that the museum could easily, I feel like, take up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they'd have to change the layout of the Egyptian galleries, but okay. You know, that the museum could easily take up to care slightly more conscientiously for the remains and the beliefs of the people whose tomb they now are.
And there's that word care again.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. That's really interesting.
So later in this episode, as you mentioned, we are going to be talking a lot, I think, about these questions of display, of conservation, of care, of agency that I'm really interested in, and how they relate to the museum as a space and institution,
mm-hmm.
and its history more broadly. Also, of course, to ideas about decolonizing the museum, which we'll definitely get to. And I'm curious about this idea of, you know, the kinds of responses we can have, the kinds of creative actions we can take to care for these people or items. And, you know, even in terms of museum policy, you know, what matters, who gets to decide this? And it intersects really interestingly with sort of the history of the human remains debate.
Right.
Okay. So do you know anything about this?
A couple of examples, you know, of specific debates are popping into my head. Yeah. So, but I think the wider history is less present in my
The reason I asked was it intersects with some very sort of medical history stuff, which is the Human Tissues Act, especially.
Yes.
Which I think was either created or rewritten in like 2004. And it's sort of 2004, 2005, 2006, where I think the height of the intensity around these debates around human remains comes into play. And that's for a few reasons. It has to do with the Alder Hey organs scandal, which was basically, it was just people discovering that the NHS was holding organs of people without their consent transplants. Okay. And so the Human Tissues Act was sort of partly responding to that, but it was also then taken up as a practical tool because there are such strict rules which govern moving, owning, keeping, displaying human remains.
Right.
It was, you know, used as a tool to deaccession some of the human remains, some of the most contentious human remains in museum collections.
Okay.
So I spoke to Hedley Swain for this episode, who was very kind to speak to me. And he was one of the people who helped write sort of the museum guidance for the care of human remains. He was the chair of the drafting group.
Right. And that was like 2005, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as I was speaking to him, some really interesting stuff came up. Firstly, he said that the debate has quietened down recently, perhaps because of the issues around decolonizing the museum more broadly. But
meaning that the decolonizing question is more important than...
It seems to have come up more now.
But it's interesting because they're intertwined.
They're definitely intertwined. But I think he means specifically the focus now is on things like the Benin bronzes, those sorts of things, rather than on things like, actual bodies in collections. And he says that he thinks one of the reasons for that is because some of the most contentious stuff was returned. Definitely not all of it. There's a huge amount that's still in collections. But he was meant specifically, you know, in 2006, the British Museum received a repatriation request from the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre and the Australian government to have two cremation bundles returned of Aboriginal ancestors.
Okay.
And they did return them. There's lots of stuff that they're not returning.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, you don't hear that often.
Right. And there was some other, I think, the Natural History Museum gave back some stuff, either Manchester or Liverpool. You know, there was some action around it. And, you know, the debates that I'm referring to is basically just some of the stuff we've been talking about. But, you know, it's partly to do with the fact that human remains are recognized as, quote, culturally sensitive materials.
Right.
And, you know, they are a place where things like context matters a lot and shifts so immensely, not just among but within specific cultures. You know, what I might think is appropriate when it comes to a dead body is different from what someone else might think is appropriate. It changes with temporally, how we might think about ancient bodies versus someone who died last week.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important... I'm sure we'll talk about that more, but I have thoughts on that. Yeah.
And of course, questions of appropriateness of display. You know, there's an extreme humanist position, there's an extreme religious position, and sort of people end up falling often somewhere in between. But, you know, just this question of what are the rights of the dead? Who gets to determine them? When or at what stage do these rights cease? And what is the responsibility of museums that own these items, these bodies, these people?
Yeah. And I think it's important to think about, like, in terms of, okay, so we're an art history podcast, or we're an art podcast, visual culture, right? Technically. So it's interesting thinking about museums as the vehicle for classing things as objects. You know what I mean? Like, if the body was in a morgue, it wouldn't be thought about this way as something that was collected. Museum is, like, the arbiter of a piece of material culture, a piece of history.
It displays it, right? And I think that that's important because it's not like there aren't cultures, many cultures, including, I am led to believe, Catholic culture, where, you know, you have like a wake, is it? Like, or open casket funerals. Not like, you know, or there are plenty of religious practices throughout the world where seeing the dead body, interacting with the dead body, often years after the body is dead, is still an important part of the grieving process.
Yes.
But that's not the same as putting something publicly on display. I mean, how many of the bodies remains in a museum gave any kind of consent or had any conception of the sheer volume of people and the means in which they would be displayed? So it's not display in and of itself that's the issue necessarily. It's the context of it, right? That this is like the mummy, Ginger the mummy in the British Museum is very different from your grandma in her open casket funeral that people are coming to pay respect
for. Friends and family. Yeah. Versus every tourist and whoever comes to London.
Right. And I think that, you know, it has to do with one of the things I'm fascinated by, which I did a lot in my undergrad, which is the history of death and our relationship, how important our relationship to our dead is. And how we have this intuition that human bodies, and legislation recognizes that human bodies have some special status. And like, sort of just from the archaeological perspective, it's one of the things that people believe makes us human, right?
Right.
You know, people look, burial practices, burying the dead, is a thing that seems to distinguish humans from almost all other life. And so often in the archaeological record, the fact that someone is buried is a flag for a set of human beliefs and practices, especially going back really far.
Sidebar, have you heard of Caitlin Dowdy?
No.
So she trained as a mortician and now she writes books and does YouTube videos like about death.
Yeah.
And I read one of her books a couple years ago and it was all about different burial rites and ideas. It was exactly this thing, like these ideas around death. Like, why are we so freaked out by death now when so many other cultures before us, or even right now, not in Western cultures, like live with the body, take care of the body before, like burying.
And consume the body.
Yeah. And she is really, it's really good at, it definitely changed the way that this book that I read by her, I think it's called Traveling the World to Find the Good Death or something.
Yeah.
And it's about this idea of a good death and how to not feel like you're going into a mechanized
situation. I can talk about this endless. This is my favorite topic. One of the most life-changing classes I ever took was with Professor Zoe Crossland in my undergrad. And it was this class called Death in the Body. It was such a political moment of awakening for me in so many different levels. One of the things I thought was interesting that Hedley Swain said to me was, you know, when they surveyed people about this, something like 86 or 87% of the public said they expect to see bodies when they go to museums.
Interesting.
And in Friends of the Pod's pod, Cursed Objects, they recently had this excellent episode that we'll link to and that you should definitely go and listen to, where they had the amazing Alice Proctor on, and they talked a little bit, among other things, about mummies.
Yeah.
And about how just ingrained it is in us that you'll see a mummy when you go to the museum.
Yeah.
And Alice pointed out, you know, most regional authorities, like most museums in the UK, actually have mummies because of the Egyptology craze from the 19th century, 18th century, and how, like, wrapped up in colonialism it was, right? And how wrapped up in the origins of the museum, because museums were partly built and established to house these collections, which were partly from sort of the race, quote unquote, big scare quotes, like race for Egypt, race for Africa,
you know,
wanting, like competing with France and trying to control these resources.
And yeah, that's the first hint of maybe museums are imperialist projects that I'm sure we're going to have more of in this episode.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting and I want your take on is in that episode, both Alice and I think Kasia said quite strongly, she doesn't believe in displaying human remains at all.
Yeah.
And I did, I got in touch with Kasia after the episode to ask some questions about it because I don't know how I feel about it. And I think for me in cases, you know, we'll talk a little bit about some of the most famous cases I already mentioned, the Tasmanian case, you know, of restitution of violently taken bodies. But there's other cases where I think it's more complicated. I don't know. And I have actually changed my mind a little bit after talking to her. You know, Kasia said for her, it's sort of about how we consume these bodies.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And I'm curious about how you feel, especially because, I mean, everyone knows the theme of this podcast. We're into stuff.
And that's the thing, is like, I love going to the Hunterian. I love seeing, you know, bits of bodies and being kind of fascinated and grossed out, but also, you know, trying to go about it in a reverent way. And, you know, I also deal with this when I write about bodies and photographs of bodies and medicalized and pathologized bodies. She said, you know, it's about consumption. It's about how you're consuming the body. And for me, it's when I'm doing my work, it's about like how I am treating the bodies and the patients like in my writing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a similar thing. But in terms of displaying bodies, I had that reaction when I listened to that episode too, and I was like, oh, I don't think that I'm, you know, 100% against it all of the time. And I started to think about it a little bit more, and I don't know where I stand on it, but I know I'm not in the camp like human remains should not be displayed.
Yeah, I mean, and I think maybe it's worth also saying that in Alice's book, which I'll also link to, she says that the reason she feels so strongly is that she's never yet seen a respectful display of the bodies, okay. Which I think is interesting, and I need to think more about it. Yeah. But what I would say is this, that the thing you said, it's very much about context, of course.
Yeah.
And the thing you said about, like, sometimes being a bit grossed out by it, like, that, I find that effect in some cases and not in others. Yeah. And I think in different contexts, and that's important. So, you know, for me, there are certain displays of bodies, including at the British Museum, where I find myself unbelievably moved by them.
Yes.
And I visit them like friends, the way I do with paintings that I love.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize that even that comparison in itself shows that it's a unidirectional relationship, right? That in some way I'm seeing them as objects. But it's a little deeper and more emotive and more complex than that for me. And I appreciate that in many ways it's unidirectional and that these people didn't explicitly consent to this. And I feel very different when it's like an obviously, you know, like the shrunken heads
at the Pitt Rivers Museum. Yeah.
But there are many cases, and we'll get to this too, where I don't know that I have an emotional reaction to them, and as opposed to for instance the Hunterian, where it's like a child's disarticulated face with smallpox because it's a medical museum and it's showing this as an oddity, and the feelings we have about quote-unquote freak shows and quote-unquote oddities is different. I think
absolutely, and that's what I was going to say. I did want to clarify, like, the grossed out thing. Like, I think that's very specific for me at places like the Hunterian.
Yeah, and human fetuses in jars.
Yeah, I was thinking more specifically of this...
Smallpox face?
No, sorry, I was thinking of the smallpox face. I was thinking of, the first time I went to the Hunterian when I first moved to London. And the Hunterian is a medical museum in London. It's been closed for a while. It's reopening in 2023. And I walked in, and, you know, they've got all these wet specimens. And I think there is a difference between dry and wet. And I do think the growth, the disgust reaction is something, like, visceral about seeing a wet specimen as opposed to a skeleton or whatever. But I remember I walked in, was, like, looking at all these specimens with all the labels, being like, wow, so cool, so edgy. I'm in London. This is great. And then I read the label of one of them, and it was an anus. That had been, like, just, like, cut out and, like, in a wet specimen. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe I was looking at that the whole time. Didn't realize what it was. And so, like, it's a very specific, like, disarticulated body that makes me feel gross. And it is damp. Like, and it's that wetness that does that
so,
for me.
So interesting. Maybe we should do an episode on wetness as well. Yeah. But, like, absolutely. Because if I even think about, you know, what freaks me out or grosses me out about other sorts of dead bodies in their representation, which I want to get to, is when you can see the sort of, like, quote-unquote wet... matter.
It's so different.
The viscera.
Yeah.
The cutting of the skin, that it turns it into something that is a lot more violent than just death, which I don't think of as violent.
Yeah.
And so how someone died, I think, is also important. And in the case of medical museums, I think it's a fascinating example, because you'd be lying if you said that they didn't benefit from the fact that there's this shock factor that is different from their original intention, which was for medical students to study. Now it's still a teaching museum, right?
Yeah.
The Hunterian, and we'll get back to the education function of the museum
versus entertainment. Yeah,
versus entertainment. But in places like anatomy museums, it's fascinating because they're a little bit more blood.
Yes, and I actually, Linda Need writes about this. She's got this article on photographs of boxing, the face punch, and she writes about pulp as something that is like.
You should see my expression. I love Linda Need so much. Have I already said on this podcast that I once
got... No, we haven't actually talked about her.
Did I not tell you that I once got her to sign my dissertation notebook, which was unbelievably embarrassing when I realized that no one else does that.
I get so much joy out of that story because I know... Like, she was in my department during my PhD and she was my advisor. And so, like, it makes me laugh so much. I love that story so much.
I can't believe I admitted it on her.
Picturing that. Do you still have it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good, good, good. Anyway, Linda Need, incredible, incredible scholar. But she's got this work on the face punch in boxing. She writes about pulp as something that is, like, particularly affecting and powerful in photography. And she then cites the work of a German scholar, Klaus Thebolite, I think, but about, like, the... Exactly what you were just saying. It's all about moist, sheen, pulp, seeing inside a human body. And that's what's effective about these types of images. It's not so much, like, if the boxer was just passed out on the ground, it wouldn't be nearly as affecting as seeing, like, the spittle and the blood flying out of his mouth.
So,
you know?
Let's talk about photographs, because it's not unrelated to some of these questions, even though it's a little bit different from this main question of sort of museums. Because one of the things I was thinking about earlier was, there's some writing, you know, I'm thinking of Philippe Ariès, who I'm sure is out of date by this point, but about how in Western culture in the 21st century, for the past 100 years or so, we've become really distant from the corpse.
This is what Caitlin Dowdy talks about as well. Yeah. And she's like writing for a she's writing for a popular audience, but she has the same idea. Like,
right.
We are not entrenched in death.
No.
We don't think about it, and therefore it's scary.
I mean, even if you think about something like the infant mortality rates of the Victorian period versus now, that like there was a real living with death that was present all the time, and, you know, overcrowding in cemeteries and all this other stuff, and in death in very visceral ways, in ways that we're not the polished makeuped, you know, what's the word, like in the morticians like, you know, beautified body in the coffin. But I feel like these days we see dead bodies in two ways, or I guess if you're Catholic in a third way, but okay, sure, in an open casket funeral when it's beautified, in museums, and in photographs.
Yes. But okay, yeah, so this idea of photography and death. So what are the ways that you're thinking of photography being used?
Okay, I wanted to show you two different artistic, projects which photograph dead bodies. Because I know that you look at a lot of dead bodies in a different way, right? Which is like partly through the history of medicine and medical imagery.
Or very near death.
Right,
or,
but which is scientific image.
Exactly.
But I'm talking about sort of art images of death. So we have two. This was an exhibition at Wellcome a few years ago that Hedley Swain actually told me about, called Life Before Death. And it's a photographer who took photos of people right before and then right after they died. And each one is accompanied by a little narrative. So this one explains, you know, Edelgard Clavey, 67, first portrait in December 5, 2003. It's sort of a little narrative. She was divorced in the early 80s, lived on her own, had no children. She contracted cancer about a year before she died, and towards the end, she was bedbound. Once she was very ill, she felt a burden to society and really wanted to die.
Wow.
And then, second portrait, January 4,
2004. Barely less than a month later,
Death, it's a quote, "Death is a test of one's maturity. Everyone has got to get through it on their own. I want very much to die. I want to become a part of that vast, extraordinary light. But dying is hard work. All I can do is wait. I was given my life, I had to live it, and now I'm giving it back."
Wow.
And I wanted to ask what your response to these is.
Well, my first response is like, ooh, I don't like that. You know, I don't think that people should be photographing close-up facial portraits of the dead. But then with the narrative, and you think, okay, this is a collaboration?
Yeah, they've all consented to this.
Yeah, of course. I mean, of course they would have to for this to be... You know, and the Wellcome is really, like, runs
about,
a lot of
yeah.
projects around consent and display.
I found it very moving.
I think it's very moving once, I think the stories, it's the combination of photograph and text, though, that makes it. If it was missing that, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, and I also, the sort of, it's a close-up, each photo is a close-up of the person's face.
Yeah, and I think that by having the text, you're also getting a flavor of that.
Yeah.
You're getting a sense of the person so much more than just their body and the representation of it.
So then I want to show you another one by
That was really cool, yeah.
Famous provocateur, Andres Serrano. You might know him from Piss Christ. But I want to give you a heads up, and you can choose not to look at these if you don't. But they're all photographs. It's a series titled The Morgue.
Okay.
And it's all photographs of bodies in a morgue. And being a provocateur, he also focuses specifically on, like, sometimes on genitalia, some different things. So, like, they're more bodily. Do you want to describe some of... I don't know if you want to zoom in on some of them, but I just want to add that we're looking at a bunch at once right now, but they're identified like this, rat poison suicide. They're identified by their form of death, and there's no story.
Yeah, which infectious pneumonia. I think is a lot more problematic, but once again, he's trying to provoke. Okay, and then that one that you just went by, hold on. Yeah, this one I find particularly problematic. It's death by asphyxiation, and it's a... It's an upshot of the genitals of the penis, and then the figure is clasping their hands and holding a crucifix that are dangling over the penis. And you just can't help but think, like, what the fuck would this person think about being displayed in an art gallery, I assume, in this way?
Yeah.
And you don't think of the morgue, you know, we were talking about that earlier, you don't think of the morgue as a place of display, as a place of audience and entertainment.
No. And it's even if it's not entertainment, it's certainly display. And I find these shocking, these images. I don't even want to show you all of them, honestly. Like, no. There's some, you know, this one's death by asphyxiation. But I mean, that's their, and I don't know if these people consented.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
I can't imagine.
But maybe their relatives did. I don't know. I haven't done a deep dive. But like, regardless of consent, I have to say, in this case, I mean, it's meant to shock, but it's very shocking. And this question of appropriateness, I think, is fascinating.
But it's interesting that this is, you know, around the period of, like, the Sensation exhibition.
It's 1992.
Yeah, the YBA's Young British Artist, where it was, like, contemporary art is always supposed to be, or it was, you know, you could get noticed if you were taking that one step further towards the taboo and towards the shocking. And this just feels, to me, like one step too far.
And the denarrativization of them is part of it. And I think that these questions of appropriateness, narrative, and display are really central to what we're talking about.
And just one more thing, I do think by, as you say, taking away the narrative and making the title Death by Asphyxiation, it's negating all life. And this person just becomes
how they died,
which is not.
And spoiler, they're almost all violent.
Well, yeah, because that's the only way that it would be shocking enough for him to, you know, it's not going to be died of old age.
No. So yeah, thinking about sort of photography.
Yeah, so I have so many thoughts about photography and ethics because of the work that I do on medical imagery. And I don't normally work on, you know, I don't work as often on photographs of death, but this idea of ethics and repatriation and photography got me thinking about Renty. Do you know about the Free Renty movement?
No, very vaguely.
Okay, so Renty was an enslaved person who had his photograph taken in 1850, I believe. Mm-hmm. So like very early photography. It's the first known photograph of an enslaved person. And the Free Renty movement was basically one of his descendants, whose last name is Lanier, Tamara Lanier. She sued Harvard University in the Peabody Museum, which holds these images. They own the right to this image of her great-great-great-grandfather.
Is it the one that I'm seeing here?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I've seen the photo before.
Okay, so he was the subject of, you know, some of the very, very first photographs of enslaved people. And so Harvard owns the daguerreotypes, so the photographic medium. So it's not like the family doesn't have access to the images. Yeah, it's the idea of having the rights over them. And so they, you know, the family argues that these photographs were seized from Renty. So it's in the way that they're using that word seize makes me think of, you know, it's as bodily as like pulling a tooth or plucking some hair. Yeah, or taking the person out there. Home, which he was from Congo, like the photographic medium is the reiteration of that violence, of that seizure.
Which is itself redoubled by the museum, this institution continuing to hold them.
And so it's
objects.
Reenacting,
like, and profiting off.
Reenacting bodies as objects, which is what chattel slavery
was. Yeah, and continuing to profit off them.
Exactly. And so it's even worse that these photographs were taken by a scientist, racial scientist. You know, we talked about scientific racism back in episode 3.
Like, what, to, like, prove the superiority
of, like... Exactly. They were used as objects of white supremacy, and it just really shows you how photography is tied up with histories of imperialism and racism. Like, it is an imperialist tool because it grew up around the same time as these practices, and because it was seen as objective, which, once again, is something that we've talked about a lot, it was the perfect tool for that. And so there's this really great little article by a scholar named Ariella Aisha Azoulay called Reparations Photography in the Imperial Premise of Scholarship.
Mm.
And she talks about the Free Renty case and the idea that photography can be used as reparations to undo what it had done in the first place. So she says that their lawsuit can constitute as a restitution claim. So we're talking about restituting objects from libraries. So giving the rights back to the family is kind of the same thing as, you know, not the same thing, but a similar process as getting, you know, the Parthenon marbles back to Greece. It's a restitution, it's a reparation. And it's about, according to Azoulay, the right to repair and care for the relationships that are contained within this object.
back to care again.
Exactly, yeah. Back to care. And Asli even says, quote, this image is family.
Yeah.
Which I find really, and that's kind of the argument that Lanier makes. You know, it's, this is what this image is to them, and that's what should matter. You know and, what I mean? Not necessarily what the image is to the museum or yeah. to the university.
But it's also really fascinating to me. I mean, that gets into, touched on a lot of topics we're talking about, right? Like repatriating bodies and objects, objects as bodies, bodies as objects.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the context in which the photograph was taken matters. Like, you know, the fact that it's being, what purposes it's being used for, what imperialist modalities it's furthering
yeah.
through its creation. And that gets me into, you know, I want to talk a little bit about some of the most famous sort of cases and controversies relating to some of the human remains stuff, just very briefly to yeah, give people sure. a sense of what I mean when we're talking about some of these human remains things. And it you know, brings up a lot of these things we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The Moko Mokai, which I think Alice also writes about in her book, was quite a famous example where, yeah, just that, you know, what they are basically is the preserved heads of Maori, the indigenous peoples of New Zealand. And, you know, they were horrifically stolen and gained by imperial authorities during the 19th century and, you know, ended up in a bunch of museums. And there was, you know, a lot of action around getting them to repatriate the heads back to the people who could best care for them. And, you know, that for me, it's quite an obvious example of a case in which it was absolutely not okay for the museum not only to ever have had these people in the first place in their collections, but in any way to continue to hold on to them, you know, especially right. it's such a clear cut case, actually, you know, yeah. where it's like people have made this claim, have asked for their ancestors back.
Yeah.
You know, the museum has to capitulate.
Yeah. And that's once again, you know, really similar to the Shrunken Head situation at the Pitt Rivers, which is like, they were on display as this kind of like, ooh, scary, creepy. And they're from, you know, a culture that lived along the Amazon, and those have now, they're taken off display. I actually don't think they've been sent back.
I don't think so either.
But they haven't been on display since 2020. And I think there's also something about heads and, once again, faces, you know, this idea of, like, this is where the personhood is situated.
It's also really interesting to me when museums choose not to display them, because then it's like, dude, just give it back. Yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? I mean, it's especially, you shouldn't have them in the first place, but if you're making a certain case, okay, I don't think this is valid in the case of indigenous bodies, but with other bodies, which we'll get to, if you're making the case that display in some way furthers, you know, what's the wording of the guidance, that it in some ways furthers knowledge or...
It makes a material contribution to a particular interpretation that could not be made in another way. And
right.
That's from the guidance for human remains, or paraphrase from the guidance of human remains.
And it's like, if you have them off display, like, send them back. And so many museums, like, what we see on display is a fraction of the human remains.
I think...
held by institutions in the UK.
There's some crazy number about the Museum of London and how many skulls they have.
Yeah.
Obscene yeah. number of skulls.
And so that for me is, like, quite a clear case that hits on a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, like, why it's... obviously, absolutely ethically unacceptable to mm-hmm. keep holding on to those people and their bodies and their remains. And but I think the mummies is actually a slightly different and more interesting case.
Yeah.
And I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but one of the reasons I'm interested in it is, okay, so that's a slightly more complex issue, right? Where the individuals themselves, the pharaohs, believed strongly in the afterlife and believed that they needed to be in their tomb in Egypt in this site-specific place and, like, had all these important rituals around the objects that were associated with them, bringing offerings to the dead, all this other stuff. But today, Hedley Swain was telling me, like, they're among the most uncontroversial, and I've read this too, they're among the most, in some ways, uncontroversial holdings of human remains in museums, because Egypt itself isn't really claiming them, asking for them back. But one of the things that we'll get to when we talk about Gala Paris Kim is she has a slightly different view that I also agree with and buy, which is that there's this other case in which, well, in this case, we know the individuals themselves didn't want to be in the museum. Okay, they couldn't conceptualize the idea of a museum, but, like, it goes against, like,
yeah.
you know, like,
yeah, so
it's not
like,
that Egypt's
not the government
us.
Says.
Yeah, who cares yeah. what the descendants say? But then that gets us into, you know, tricky issues with, like, legality and stuff. Anyway.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and you know, museum professionals have come up against what the public wants versus giving weight to minority views in these discussions quite a lot. Because one of the famous sort of mummy-related cases was in 2008, there was this controversy where the Manchester Museum, in convo with this pagan-led group called Honouring the Ancient Dead, okay. which has some pagans on its sort of board or whatever, including the woman who's currently, well, she's in the Druid Network, I don't know if she's in charge, But they just outright sort of don't believe in the display of, you know, human bodies, especially ancient bodies. And so in response to this, Manchester Museum, like, covered up a bunch of mummies, like, with sheets. And then the public complained, and they just, like, uncovered them.
Yeah, so actually, this makes me think of, like, once again, talking about museums and controversial bodies and, like, ones that have had public outcry, right? So there was this particular body is held in the Hunterian, and it's called the quote-unquote Irish Giant, or Charles Byrne. That was his name. And he lived in the 18th century. He lived for about 22, 23 years because he had a type of gigantism that, you know, you don't live that long.
Yeah.
Anyway, his skeleton is displayed in the Hunterian, and the Hunterian was the collection of John Hunter, who was a famed surgeon in the 18th century. And the Charles Byrne, you know, made all of his money during his life displaying his huge body to, like, 18th century London.
Yeah, the display. freak show genre of sort of Victorian.
Exactly. And I think we can take a lot of parallels between, like, medical museums or displays of bodies and Victorian freak show, but that's a whole other story. But anyway, so Charles Byrne explicitly said, when I die, I want to be buried at sea.
Yeah.
And I want to be weighted down because I do not want the scientists to get me.
Yeah.
And John Hunter, sneaky dick, basically, they think what he did is, as his body was in his casket in a carriage to go get buried, John Hunter hired someone to swap it out. Christ. And he, like, hastily, you know, turned it into a skeleton. They think that there are some splotches on the skeleton where you can see, like, poor, you know, techniques being used.
Yeah.
And he apparently paid about 500 pounds, which was a lot in that time.
But that's quite a clear-cut case where it's, like, completely inappropriate for this body
and,
to be
displayed. There could be an argument where it's like, well, he was all about displaying his body in life.
No, but
so, like,
he said no.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He said no. And so there's been all of this pushback to it, like, publicly from, there was a big publication in the British Medical Journal in 2011 that got a lot of support and pushback, like, no, this is for science, it's fine. And then Hilary Mantel, like, the best-selling author, called for his body to be, like, taken out of the Hunterian, of course, because she's a celebrity, like, that got a lot of play. But the Hunterian closed back in, what, 2017?
Yeah.
And they haven't said whether it'll be back on display when they reopen in 2023. And I think it'll be really interesting. I think even since 2017, the conversation
has shifted
so much, the conversation that we're having right now. And I also think, sorry, just going back to Hunter, he obviously knew what he was doing was wrong because he waited for 4 years to display the skeleton.
And I think it maps a lot onto, you know, this idea of decolonizing the museum and the very structure of the museum in relation to some of the things we've been talking about is interesting, right? So, like, you know, museums are inherently colonial institutions that existed, were created to collect and display the wealth and the riches of empire that were, like, explicitly stolen in many cases, and which, you know, we have seen through stats about, like, who feels comfortable in the museum and not continue in many ways to perpetuate some of the forms of racism, obviously not in the same ways, but, you know, as you know, in their formation. And it also maps into one of our favorite topics, which is the history of science in interesting ways, because the sorts of collecting and display and what they prioritize maps onto the taxonomies definitely originally of, like, Enlightenment science. And it links back to this idea of science being like, it's important for us to display these things for the better knowledge of all humankind, when in reality it's more complicated.
Yes, and that also ties back with the Renty photographs, like, thinking about that as a form of taxonomy. And Jennifer Tucker writes about how scientific advancements and photographic advancements, like, paralleled each other as benefiting the empire, and so did museums, because, once again, if you have these big, beautiful buildings showing, like, with all the treasures of the world, like, obviously people are going to think, oh, London is, like, a cultural center, when in reality you stole it from everywhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
And photographs prove that it is yours, you know, they help you to, like, it's all interlinked, science, photography, collecting, museums. Yeah.
And I think it's a very, you know, when the museum is, like in the indigenous cases that we talked about, like when the museum is actively replicating the brutal colonial practices that they, you know, under which they were formed to this day, like when they refuse to return bodies that have been requested by people for whom the act is both spiritually and, like, viscerally important and of, like, significant historical symbolic significance, right? Like in the Free Ranty case as well.
Yeah,
I mean, definitely. I'm curious. We didn't really get to talk about it yet, but I think it's interesting to reflect on whether and how we feel differently about bodies which are not, you know, like either stolen, taken from violent means, or from elsewhere.
Yeah.
So for instance, I don't know if you know about the bog bodies, which is like one of my, maybe we should do a whole separate episode about them, but the bog bodies are one of my favorite things of all time. And they're human cadavers, which are naturally mummified by peat bogs. And we've found ones ranging from 8,000 BC to like the Second World War. There were lots from the Second World War, actually. Yeah. And they're particularly striking as human remains because they're mummified in such a way that they retain their features.
Wow. How have I never seen these before?
So I'm showing you Tolland Man, who's one of the most famous ones.
Wow.
And he is...
Reminds me of Lord of the Rings when they all sink into the swamp.
They think he's from around 400 and 380 BC. And, you know, the picture which we'll link to, you can see his skin, you can see his expression.
Yeah.
And he was found in Denmark, and he's remained quite an important figure in sort of the Danish sort of like self-mythology and stuff. And it gets us into a whole, there's a whole history about how he was displayed and stuff that I think is fascinating and gets into some of these issues, not only of like the ethics of display, but around how display is used to push certain narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm thinking also back to other examples of, or even Neanderthals, how think about like facial reconstructions of like ancient skeletons where they make them like blonde and blue eyed, and the specific political and ideological connotations that are pushed onto the dead almost inherently by, you know, the museum has to display, if it's going to display them, it has to display them in some way or another. And that display creates a narrative,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like that question of like, even in these cases where the bodies are not like stolen or received in some violent ways.
Yeah, I'm quite obviously like less against that, where if there's nobody calling for it or like.
And also if you think about the history of Western Christianity and like relics, for instance, that in like, let's say like British Christian culture, given that this is the country we're in, Western Catholic culture or like sort of Christianity more broadly, the idea of the display of bodies, even the consumption of bodies, if you think about transubstantiation, is not that unusual, not that shocking, foreign. Not that foreign. But yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting, like, to sort of bring it back to this idea of decolonizing the museum. You know, it gets down to one of the most difficult questions around the thing about decolonization, right? Which is that, like, by even existing, they perpetuate and uphold colonial narratives and colonial projects. And how can you begin seriously to decolonize? Like, even if, like us, you believe strongly in the practice of decolonization, what does that look like? And I'm not, you know, the British Museum should send back its shit. That's not what I'm saying here. But I do appreciate that the role of museums has shifted today. And for many people, including ourselves, they are important sites of cultural knowledge creation and exchange. And that in many, you know, I think they talked about this a bit on Cursed Objects as well. Like many museums are actively trying to incorporate other voices and other practices.
Yeah, they are.
And to turn themselves into places of knowledge sharing rather than just these relics.
Yeah, community curation, that kind of thing. Like having people from the communities write the interpretation, I think is really...
But I just, it sort of gets to my thing about, like, I don't think we should tear down museums. I don't think a lot of people do. And this sort of brings us back, I think, to Gala Paris Kim. And what I think is so interesting about her art, because it manages, I don't know if you agree, but I think it manages to find a fascinating in-between where it's offering, you know, think about the rotating the tomb on the axis, these constructive, creative ideas for how to care for the body, for how to care for these remains and these objects, without necessarily giving them back.
It's an action. And I think that's what's important about her work, is that it has momentum and it's taking a step forward, or at least a step in some direction, rather than just, you know, treading water and fretting for no reason.
It's taking a step diagonally and like...
I'm picturing that arrow. Like, it's literally taking a step along that arrow that she has.
Because what she's doing that I think is so impressive and important, she's pushing against the inherited methodologies of the museum. She says, like, you know, the museum already has these structures that in and of itself, even if you think about the registrar's office and how when you get a new object, you have to put it into the spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. And think about the form of the spreadsheet and its boxes and how hard it is for a museum to even begin to start thinking about creative ways to deal with these objects when the very structure from like the bottom up is this taxonomic, scientific, historical, you know, sort of like, I don't know, historically colonialist, historically a fraught
process.
And it links also to her idea of the spiritual caring.
Yeah, the fact that her artwork is an action, or it's a suggestion of an action, is really important, and you so rarely get that.
And I want to talk about some of the creative ways that she's done this. And, like, importantly, she talks a lot about a question of care, of the, like, you know, these objects have this clear physical function within the museum that the conservation team, for instance, is very concerned with. How do we preserve these bodies? How do we care for them in these practical ways? And she says, what about the intangible stuff? She talks about, what about things that were meant to be never-ending, like the site-specificness of the Egyptian pharaohs, for instance? Mm-hmm. You know, what about things where their original function is ongoing for communities, for individuals, as, like, spiritual agencies? And I just want to close on a couple of objects in which she's dealing with this, and I want your take on them.
Great.
So I'm going to start with the object that I didn't show you at the beginning.
Okay.
Which is, if you'll remember, about the British Museum. So it's this one here.
Okay. It looks like a landscape.
Yep. It's a view.
Okay.
So what we're looking at is a large drawing. And in the exhibition, it's striking. It's, like, really big. And it has these weird folds, sort of at different points, sort of going straight down in the image. And what the drawing is doing is, it's a desert landscape that's familiar to sort of, well, there's a funerary statue that's held at the British Museum of Nenkhefta, who was an old kingdom sort of nobleman. And the drawing is a view that he would have known from his, like, original place in Egypt. And so the reason it has scoring is that she envisages it as being folded around his vitrine to shield it from the view of the public, but so that he can see it.
Wow. Yeah, goosebumps. Yeah, I really like that.
How genius. Such
a creative intervention, and I really appreciate it, because I would never think, and it would be so wonderful to see that in a space like the British Museum.
Yeah,
like,
and how powerful would that impact be? It would be
so powerful, but I just can't envision a collaboration like that happening.
So actually, there's a really interesting conversation she had with the curator that she wrote to.
Because of this letter?
Yeah, that I'll link to.
Okay.
And because of the exhibition, where they discussed some of these ideas. And it was quite interesting, because it also underscores something that, you know, they were talking about in the Cursed Objects episode as well, which is often museum staff want to do things, and then there's, like, other, you know, restrictions around them. I don't know if the British Museum necessarily needs our sympathy in that respect, but, you know, he was, you know, talking about things like the facing of the body and, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting, I'll link to the interview. But it was like a breath of fresh air for me to see this. And it shifted entirely how I'd been thinking about it. And another example, you know, because she's interested in the ongoing spiritual well-being of objects. Another example is this one. So do you want to describe what we're looking at here?
Yeah. So this is the image that you sent through when you saw this exhibition. And so this is an abstract painting. I mean, it's got really vibrant yellows and greens, some black, some, like, peach colors, orange, and it's all swirled in, like, buckets of paint have just been dripped and kind of marbled together. And it's a very large, like, abstract expressionist looking
kind of vibe.
Absolutely.
So this work's called Terminal Escape from the Place That Binds Us.
Okay.
And it's not painted, it's ink.
Okay.
You know, like, the front and end papers of, like, 19th century
books. That's why I said marble. Exactly, it does have that and sense.
Basically, she deployed encromancy, which is an ancient form of ink divination, to try and contact, to be in dialogue with spirits inhabiting human bones at the Gwangju National Museum.
Did she do this in situ at the Korea museum? Because I'm just wondering how she would be in contact with it.
But what ends up emerging is this fantastic map to nowhere.
Interesting.
You know, that the spirits have communicated where they want to be, and the result is this topography, this terrain that is unnavigable.
It's illegible.
That's illegible.
But she's still doing something. She's still trying to get to the root of consent and action and display.
And in the letter that accompanies it, she says, the actual place remains illegible to us and might not even exist on our planet, but this could be a first step to acknowledge the agency of that person. And it also reminds me of the final work that I want to talk about, which also was sort of, like, stopped me in my tracks. Can you see what this is? It's like mold. It's this enormous framed piece of muslin.
Cloth.
Where they basically propagated spores from the storage from stores in the British Museum.
Yeah.
That spores that probably might have eaten, you know, have consumed some of the body, some of the flesh, the human remains within the institution. And so by cultivating them on this Muslim thing, she's literally bringing back to life the dead and moving it out of the museum.
Giving it a new home.
And giving it a space where it continues to grow. So it perpetuates the sense of like sort of the living.
So this piece will look different as time goes on because the mold will continue to grow. And it looks quite empty when you first see it. And holy shit, that is so cool.
Sorry, I just showed her. I showed Christy the earlier stages of the object and then later stages where the mold has grown more.
Wow. Yeah. And so, but once again, this looks like, once again, like a map to nowhere. Yeah. Like, okay, these spores, if they have ingested these bodies, you know, and it's almost like they're telling us where those bodies want to go, but we just can't read them yet.
And for me, it's just like, it's the most brilliant approach to this sort of impasse we're at in terms of some of the conversations about repatriation and return and stuff, where it's, this question of agency and how do we give these bodies and these individuals back their agency, which almost doesn't have much to do with the ethics of what you'd believe human display to be, you know? I mean, for me, and I think one of the reasons I think her work is so fascinating and such a great way to end our first season of Drawing Blood is because in many ways it's a reversal of some of the relationships between art and its sort of broader context and the broader themes that we've been looking at throughout this first season, right? So instead of, or in addition to, her art being an interesting jumping off place for us to explore questions like, you know, in this case, the history of museums and display, of death, of the body, you know, the treatment of the dead, it's a direct and practicable intervention into the actual practices of museum curation and display
through art,
that people can carry forward. And it shows why we need art and why it is this, can be this enlivening, you know, this enlivening process for not just like generating debate, but creating active change.
I think that's the important thing, because I think a lot of times the argument for art is that, oh, but it's getting people talking. That's what matters the most. It's getting, bringing awareness, but like awareness only goes so far, and it is about these actionable pieces. Yeah. And that's exactly what she's doing, and you so rarely see that. And, you know, those photographs in the morgue, quote-unquote, spark debate, but in the worst possible way, you know what I mean? Where, and she's on the opposite end of that coin.
I'm so struck by how caring her letters are.
Yes, that's
care. And how kind.
Yeah.
You know, and how generous and generative, like, to the people that she's writing to, assuming that they want things to change, you know, and offering suggestions for how.
And that is a wrap on our last episode of season one of Drawing Blood. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. Please continue to retweet our tweets, subscribe, rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We love hearing what you guys think. We also really want to thank C.S. Merkling for the audio editing for this episode and for all of the episodes in season one. He's done such a brilliant job. And we also wanted to say, keep an eye out for season two. We're hoping to start recording that this summer. We already have so many ideas for season two and season three. We'll be talking about things like The Sims 4, a paranormal expansion pack, and like seances and video games. We will be talking about M. Night Shyamalan's new film, Old. We've got so many ideas. So if any of that sounds like your cup of tea, keep listening. And XOXO.
Bye.
Bye.